Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Good day to you one and all. It is I, Justin Hawkett. This apparently means power and control. It was what Tony Blair used to... Doesn't matter about that. Anyway, today is an in-person, long-form podcast chat with one of my favourite artists, Rick Astley, who won all of last summer with his performance at Glastonbury singing those Smith songs and doing AC/DC drum stuff. It was really awesome to talk to him. We covered so much ground and there was a load of tangential meanderings that... Well, they excite me, and you're going to love it. He was an amazing guest, and it was really, really cool. I sort of feel so inspired that I want to touch the keyboard, but there's people talking near it. So let's do that. Enjoy. Good day to you, one and all. It is I, Justin Hawkins, and this is Justin Hawkins Rides Again. Today, on the Long Form podcast, my guest is the inimitable Rick Astley.
I love what you did with that R there.
Thank you. I always try and roll it.
I know you do,
dear. It makes me sound really sophisticated, I think. I'm a self-made man, you know.
Yeah. It's also, it's a bit continental as well, I think.
Yeah. It's rolling more inclusive of an R. For the mainlanders.
Yeah, maybe.
Definitely.
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm very good, actually. I wasn't super well over Christmas. I've been like a lot of people, kind of, you know, you work right up to Christmas and then just go boom.
Yeah.
But we had a nice time anyway.
It wasn't COVID, was it?
No, I kept checking for it. I kept testing and it kept saying no.
Yeah.
And so I believed
it. That's a good sign.
But I just had no energy and was just completely flat. And I'm getting myself back together and I kind of feel normal again, you know.
But just before Christmas, you did that thing, didn't you?
We did. Do you mean the New Year's Eve show, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was on, we actually recorded it on the 12th at the Roundhouse.
Yeah.
Which, as you know, obviously.
Cracking venue.
It's just great, I think. Yeah. And I've been to a couple of, been to gigs, but I've also been to a couple of events there. And thought, this is a venue that you can almost do anything in.
Yeah.
The venue itself has got so much charm about it that wherever you put a camera, it's kind of interesting. It's not just a breeze block wall. You
I
know.
Think sound-wise, it's probably quite challenging because it's...
Yeah, maybe. Round.
Hence the name.
But I think we were really, really happy that we did it there because it sort of, it felt like a proper gig. Obviously, we were shooting it to be a TV moment, but... Mm-hmm. It felt right that we had a real audience who wanted to be there. You know, we didn't usher them
so
in.
How much of an audience can you have in a place like that when you've got to set it up like a TV thing?
Well,
because, I mean, I did the Sam Ryder one. There's huge gaps in the audience where they've got rigging and tracks and stuff.
To be honest, I think, as I remember it, I don't seem to... I think they had a crane in, obviously, and a couple of, you know, obviously the technical crew were, you know, everywhere kind of thing. But they did an amazing job of being discreet about and keeping it like a gig. So for us on stage, it felt like
a gig,
to be honest. Yeah, it did.
That's
the most
important.
Which was fantastic, yeah.
That probably comes across, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So how much live stuff did you do last year?
We did a bunch of gigs through the summer, different festivals. And
highlight
it's weird.
Probably being...
Well, Glastonbury comes to mind. Yeah. We also did Electric Picnic in Ireland, which was fantastic.
So is festivals a more sort of recent... thing for
you. Definitely I'd say the last maybe 4 or 5 years, just, you know, a few years before COVID, I guess. And we did one in Japan and Summer Sonic.
Oh, okay.
And
because you have to choose between that and Fuji Rocks, don't
oh
you?
Is that right? Okay, well
it used to be like that. There used to be kind of such fierce rivalry between the two promoters.
So you could do one but not the other. And
if you do
have
one,
you
you're never going to do the
oh,
other.
Oh, really? Like,
I
never
think
do
it's like
it?
That,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's how it used to be.
Good to know. So we went to Japan to do that. And that was probably one of the first big ones where I kind of went, what am I doing here? Because I looked at the lineup.
Do you mean like imposter syndrome?
Yeah, a little bit, but not in like it. I do have imposter syndrome a little bit here and there, but not as kind of like, I mean, just a logical, what am I doing here?
Right.
Because I looked at a lot
Why
of
did
bands,
they book me kind of thing?
Kind of. Mm. And it was pretty eclectic, to be fair. And there were quite a few pop things. There was even a bit of K-pop there, you know, which I found interesting because I know that's exploded over the last whatever it's decade or less or whatever, but to actually see it happening, like at the, and I didn't know who it was. I can't remember what they were called, to be honest, right now. But you know,
maybe it was BTS.
I don't think it was. It could
have
been.
That's the only one I know, actually.
Yeah, well, okay. It could have been. It could have been, but I'm not sure. But it was a whole, you know, boy band thing with the dance routines and the whole bit and everything, and the crowd, girls especially, were going mad and all the rest of it.
I was thinking, actually, did the crowd do the dance routines as well?
Well, like they'd have Macarena to go some, because they're pretty sophisticated, those routines. Oh, yeah. Oh, they're not messing around, yeah.
it's a huge part of the K-pop experience, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it is. I think that is part of it. And I think, obviously, if we look at TikTok and all these things that have been kicking off, people relate to music in not just in an audio way anymore, do they? I mean, I know there's always been videos, but it's really part of being connected to the artist as well. They do these routines, we'll do our version of it and stick that on TikTok. You know what I mean? It's like a, you know.
Do you do a lot of TikTok?
I do some TikTok. Again, I find it like, I like social media for the sense that if you, as an artist or whatever, a human, want to say something, you can. Mm. And I didn't have that growing up. There was no way of doing that, of reaching anybody. You know what I mean? You went and played in the local pub, you know, if you were lucky. And
that's how I remember it too. It's kind of like the way you find your audience was, you know, like a builder finds his clients. You know, it was word of mouth.
Word of mouth, absolutely. Because there was no other... Until I guess you, as a band or a performer or whatever, you'd get to a level where someone would come and review it. There was no way of getting anybody to know.
Yeah.
So, and one of the things I love about the social media thing is that there's some genuinely talented people who perhaps also wouldn't necessarily go the pub bar route because maybe that's not where their confidence is, or that's not where how they express themselves or what have you. And so they would have been dead in the water.
But do you not feel that the thing about the social media attention span that's required means that not really required to write full compositions.
I know
they just need to sort of...
It's a different thing.
An attention-grabbing 30-second clip or something.
Yeah, and it is a very different thing, and I think I've read a few things about this thing about even big artists only writing songs to order for a certain time limit, and I'm like, yeah, but it needs a middle age, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Well, it reminds me of... I don't know if you've done a lot of writing for other artists and stuff.
Not
like that.
Not really. I've dabbled in it, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that like my publisher used to say to me is like, "Have you got song starts?" And when they said song start, they meant verse, chorus, and bridge or middle eight.
Yeah.
You just need one of each. So like it could be because like 45 seconds of music with three different sections, and then that was what they would use to sort of farm out and then see if there's any if anyone bites, then you go and develop it and finish
and they
want
to join in obviously in co-creating,
which is a totally different way to like if you're in a band or you're or you know if you're Leonard Cohen or someone like that, you know, you'd sit there and you'd meticulously create a narrative that goes across the whole song, you know. That art form is
being killed
by social media, sort of.
Yeah, but I think what it is, I just because I'm entertained by it occasionally.
Yeah.
I like see somebody and I go, they're amazing. Who is this person? Why are they in the bedroom? What get them out of the bedroom? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every now and again.
But then,
do you find that
like the ones that are really good guitar players, they come out of the bedroom and then when they stand up, the guitar's still here?
Well, it is an interesting one because the guitar thing is again. I think the standard of musicianship has just gone like that.
Mm.
It's like crazy.
Do you think even since COVID or before?
I don't know. That's an interesting point. I don't know about that. Might have helped because people were at home, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think it's more to do with, I think, be having YouTube for 20 years or whatever it is now, 15 years properly kind of thing, where I do it all the time. I go, what are the courses that bloody thing? You know, and I'm on there and I'll find some 14-year-old kid in Kansas and he's going, look, everyone thinks it's this, but it ain't. Mm. It's actually this. You know what I mean? Mm. I'm like, oh my God, he's right, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that then spurs everyone else on and everyone's learning techniques.
I suppose
and
what we used to do is film MTV and pause it and then just sort of try and find the shape if there was something you couldn't pick out with your ear.
Yeah, I'm not very good with my ears, to be honest, which is not great for being... Well, honestly, I'm not. I hear things. Like if I go into... We've done things with string, you know, huge big things like an orchestra style thing and what have you, and I can hear something's not right, But I couldn't go over to someone and say, by the way, fourth violin, now something's going on there. I couldn't do that, do you know? But I can hear that something is not quite right. Yeah. And I'm very much like that with chords and stuff. Mm-hmm. If for whatever reason, let's say I'm doing something that's not my band, mm-hmm. and somebody jumps on the piano to play the chords to something, if they play a slightly different inversion, mm-hmm. I'm screwed. I almost have to go, whoa. Sorry.
So even the voicing,
it just puts me off a little bit. Yeah, it really puts me off. And I've done recently, actually, last Christmas, we actually did three gigs, but with a full orchestra of singing. I know everyone's done it, but I just like doing it. Frank Sinatra and Christmas songs.
The swingy numbers.
Yeah, but Christmas tunes as well, because just in the run up to Christmas.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely gorgeous. It was an amazing treat to do it. It was incredible.
Yeah. You've got the kind of voice that can sustain that.
Thank
as
you.
Well.
Thank
Not
you.
Everybody does. Everybody wants to do it.
Yeah, well...
But there's a certain charisma that you need in the timbre of your voice.
Yeah. The thing is, I am a big fan of Sinatra. I definitely am. I'm not like geeky over it where I can tell you every album he recorded and all of that. But yeah. I've read a lot of the books about him and all the rest of it, and da da da. And there's something about that dude that's never happened again. I don't care who you are. Michael Bublé does a very good job in that world and everything and all the rest of it.
Well, they signed him to do the standards and reinvigorate that.
Yeah,
that publishing catalogue.
Right.
And because he's young and he's good looking, he's got something similar in the
and he's a great singer, there's no doubt about it. But
I think he's a good songwriter as well.
Yeah, he has written some good tunes. Yeah. But I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
Something strange, like with Elvis and like with various other people, happened when that person was born.
Mm.
His voice is just like, what the hell's going on there? Mm. And yeah, I love singing them. And I think I'm okay at it, and I think
do you apply an affectation to your voice?
I try not to sing it in my way of singing,
because find it whenever I've tried to do anything, because I'm a massive fan of Scott Walker.
Oh wow.
And sometimes when I'm like writing stuff and I'm trying to imagine like what would Scott Walker do, and then it's impossible to not do a Scott Walker affectation when you're singing it. It just doesn't sound anything like me. So it's unusable.
Right, okay.
So it's like, yeah, I but just then wondered
you
if
could
you
have a you could have like an alter ego thing and go and do something that's like, what is that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'd love to do that actually.
Well, I think, I don't know about you, but I definitely feel that I've just outright pinched stuff from singers over the years when
so
I was a kid.
You admit that.
No,
it's
but
great.
Because, and I don't even think it's always conscious, but it's like, I just love the way, and I've spoken to some friends about this. When I was, I'm 57, so when I was a kid, and I first started, first band I got in, I was a drummer, actually, so I played drums, but I sang a bit as well, because I'd always sung at school in the choirs and different, you know.
And what kind of music was the band playing that you
were
playing?
Well, we were
drums
like,
in?
Well, Jeff, the bass player, loved Joy Division, so we did a couple of their songs. I loved The Police, Stuart Copeland.
Were you
Copeland.
Doing like a lot of 16th?
Oh, it's all going on. Yeah. It's tiring. And I loved The Police, because I loved The Police. But
so
Stuart
nothing
Copeland,
on the one.
It's all weird. I mean, I used to sing So Lonely and play the drums to it, which is a bit odd.
Wow.
But once you've got over the thing, I don't know how good it was,
so
but I did
so the kick drum would land on
because the kick is on the snare, isn't it? Because it's apart from when you get into the chorus, I think, and then it goes back to rock, doesn't it? Blah, blah. You know what I mean? It does that then. But in the...
difficult.
But anyway, I managed it in my own way, whatever way that was. And
drums and singing,
But it's. I still do it a tiny bit with some friends, actually, in a little mad midlife crisis rock band. But anyway, we're not going
to
that
kind.
Right now.
All rock bands are midlife crisis rock bands,
is that
even
right?
If they're in their 20s.
Okay.
Mine's lasted for the last 20 years, actually.
Not a midlife crisis. I think I had my midlife crisis in my 20s, so that suits.
A lot of singers think that, don't they?
I think,
is it because
maybe.
You have a cataclysmic change in your
probably,
lifestyle?
Probably, yeah, with mine it probably was, But I think going back to the singing thing and pinching stuff, I think like when I go back to a lot of the bands that were like mainstream pop things as well, but also some more alternative, slightly out there stuff.
Yeah.
Everyone kind of sang with an affected voice, really. there was a lot of baritone about, for one thing, lot of it. And like, if you think like Edwin Collins, you know, Orange Juice and what have you, and the sort of style of his voice, which is a bit Elvis come what have you, you know, and I mean that as a compliment, by the way. We used to sing Rip It Up and Start Again. That was one of our covers that we did.
Cool.
And but there's a lot of people who did that. So it wasn't, I think the way I ended up singing, I liked a lot of black American music, definitely. Mm. I've got two older brothers and an older sister, so I was force-fed all the music they loved and everything, which was really widespread from like progressive rock, even going into like Rick Wakeman progressive rock, if you know what I mean, and all those albums and all of that.
Synthesizer players with lots of different keyboards and a cape.
Yeah, a cape.
So important.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
We went to see my sister and eldest brother went to see him a few times on ice and everything kind of thing, and when he was going to play outside Hampton Court Palace and do
there.
The you went to that
so I
bought
the Henry VIII stuff, wasn't it?
Six Wives of Henry VIII. I know this is very flash, but I went online and bought 12 tickets, I think, because I knew immediately I'd have to like invite my brothers and my sister and their partners and a couple of friends. So we all went and we just, it was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, mad as can possibly be.
Yeah.
And also, because I don't know how many nights.
What a venue.
Yeah.
But all the seating was like, seemed like it was 100 miles. I mean, I've got poor eyesight and I couldn't see.
Oh, right, okay.
Couldn't really see the magic.
Well, that, we live really close to Hampton Court. I sort of walk past it every day on a walk kind of thing.
Yeah.
And in, I've done gigs there and you play in the quadrant, in the what's it, in kind of in the sort of cozy what have you, but he did the thing right out the front, didn't he, where he walked out of the gates, the huge big gates, and he had Brian Blessed, do you remember that, announced
I didn't remember that.
He did.
I love Brian Blessed.
He came on and did the whole, and somebody, I don't know whether he did a couple of nights, so I don't know whether at the same night, I don't know, or maybe it was one, but at one point somebody kept shouting something about, you know, you've got to do the Gordon bit, Gordon's alive, right? And in the end,
I
he
hope
said,
that wasn't me shouting. It was when I was sober.
Yeah, maybe. But in the end, he did it anyway. So, which
really?
Was pretty amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But, so I've sort of, I grew up listening to a lot of different stuff and really loving a lot of things and not really finding my own music that I like just because I had music constantly being played in someone's bedroom or in the living room.
Isn't that how influence works, though? I mean, it's kind of like you're pulling, you know, you assemble your tool set based on the things that you've enjoyed consuming.
I guess, but I never really learned to play anything as a kid. We always had a piano in the house. My mum and dad had both passed now, but my mum was like a pretty amazing piano player. Could sight read like classical and everything. But I didn't grow up with my mum. I grew up with my, it's a long story, but they got divorced and we all ended up staying at what was eventually my dad's house kind of thing. But there was still a piano there. I saw my mum every day. But I just never took to the idea of wanting to learn to play the piano, which I hate now because I'd love to have all that kind of theory and I can get on a piano and, you know.
Theory is something that you absorb just by doing it. And I think, but the problem of it is vocabulary.
Interesting.
Because I think my understanding of theory is, you know, it's improved so much over the last few years, but I still don't have the right way of expressing it to another person that understands theory.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of get it, but it's just like I'm often saying the wrong stuff.
Well, it's interesting because I don't get any of it, and I actually
I'm sure
I
you do.
Well, I don't. No, I don't. And what happens is I have a studio at home in my garage, and it's a nice garage. It's not a garage anymore. No. And I've made my own albums in there, and I've played everything, like literally every note of it. But I've no idea how. And that's not false modesty, that's just honesty.
So that's just your ear and finding
your way
around.
And I think it's pretty simple stuff that I do. It's nothing like, you know, there's no jazz chords in there, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's no kind of, it's pretty
do
much...
You know what, if I could suggest one thing. If you want to sound like a cool piano player,
yeah.
And this is a good tip for people at home, if you, like the triad chord is the root and right. the third and the fifth.
Yeah.
As soon as you put the ninth in, it makes you sound like a real piano player.
Okay.
On every chord.
Okay.
Because it can be major or minor, it's neither. And if you take that one off, then this is a good point to start a melody, because then you have to choose up or down to guide you.
You see, this is a very interesting thing, right? And I'm going to do that as soon as I get home now. I've just decided. but this
try a D and put an E in it. It just
okay,
sounds
well, this is very interesting because... I may do some of that occasionally without knowing it,
yeah.
And I don't. But the thing is, the moment you start saying put a ninth in it or what have you, there's something in my head that just goes to spaghetti. It's really weird. I just instantly go ooh.
I thought you were going to say that the magic disappears, but it.
I wouldn't say it's no,
or
no.
Just confusion.
I don't think. Yeah, it's a bit of that. I think it's a bit of. Inferiority complex and a bit of like, I don't know what he's talking about, so let's just move on to something else. And the guys that I work with, you know, the girls and the guys in the band and everything, are all like phenomenal players,
yeah.
And astounding,
well,
and can
be,
do right? anything and play anything, all the rest of it. Yeah, but they don't actually have to in my universe, because it's not that difficult to play my stuff.
Right.
There's a few, some of the Stock Aitken Waterman's are quite nifty in terms of the key changes and what they go to, and it does surprise people.
When they do a key change, is it often a semi-up, the Stevie Wonder?
You know what, I've never even thought about what they are, but there's a few, like one of my, I think it was... second single, I think, Whenever You Need Somebody, it's called, anyway. Mm-hmm. It's got some weird sort of changes, and even to sing it, when they played it to me, I went, what? And I was trying to follow Mike Stock, who used to do the vocals and everything. I'm like, where have you just gone? How the hell did you get to that note? And he had to kind of tap it out almost on a piano and say, that
really
is the melody.
If the note starts on a one, or it's even worse if it's before a one, because then you have to anticipate the change, don't
right,
you?
Right, okay, yes, yeah.
You know,
you almost need to be singing in that key.
Yeah, if it's a two or three, then you're off.
Yeah, it's
obviously clever when people just hit it straight out of the game.
Yeah, some people are annoying. But I've sung, for instance, that song so many times, I don't even think about it now. But if I do, let's say I'm somewhere...
Do you think that's muscle memory?
Yeah, I think it is, a lot of it. And I think sometimes, like, if I've been to do a TV abroad somewhere where you're going to sing with a house band or something, you know, and they've got a great band and all that, and you just jump up and do it. Quite often they've said to me after, they sort of said, that tune, man, there's some weird, what's going on there? Because they view the Stock Aitken Waterman thing, kind of rightly so, as a bit cutty-cutter and a bit like this, that and the other. But when they've actually had to play one, they've gone, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, so... It's interesting.
Well, they produced a load of stuff in the 80s, didn't they?
Just like tons of it.
Defined the sound of 80s.
A little bit. Certainly the British kind of, you know, pop thing, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, didn't they do Dead or Alive as well?
They did, which is just
edgy.
I mean, I made tea on that album.
Did you?
Yeah, because I signed to their little production company, because they weren't known. When I signed to them, I had no clue who they were. They just had a studio in London, and they'd made a few singles. And they'd had some records that, you know, I went, I think I know what that is. But not like a genuine kind of like boom, number one smash. And I signed this tiny little deal with them for no money or anything, just to kind of like, I'll get to live in London for a week and or 2 days and do a track. And then, cut a long story short, they had the first single that was massive, which was Say I'm Your Number One by Princess, which I think was a number one record. And like a few weeks later, they'd been working on the Dead or Alive You Spin Me Round track. Boom, number one again.
And that was like, that was 1985, wasn't it?
Something like that, yeah. And I ended up basically anyway becoming like a T-boy, tape hop, whatever you want to call it, dog's body in the studio. When there's a bunch of other kids
Did
there.
Did they have a nickname for you?
Git, probably.
I used to do that sort of thing. They used to call me Plimsoll.
Oh, really?
I have no idea why.
Wow, Plimsoll.
Plimsoll,
okay.
The T-boy.
Wow, where was that then?
place called Purple Rain Studios in Galston.
Oh my God.
And there was a band from up north somewhere, and they said,
gonna get some sweets foot lad.
They called me Plimsoll. And then everyone just called me Plimsoll.
Sweets foot lad. Lovely.
Get some sweets foot lad.
Amazing. But yeah, so then they got stuck into making that album, and I was just hanging around, literally just kind of hanging around, mm-hmm. and became one of the studio kids. Mm. So I made tea and played table tennis with them all. Just did what you did in the studio when, well, you know. And yeah. So it was pretty amazing to be around at that time with those guys, the Stock Aitken Waterman guys, because a lot of what they did also wasn't kind of repetitive. It did sound slightly, well, not slightly, it sounded very different. Mm. The Princess record and Dead or Alive is completely different. They're like chalk and cheese almost. They're still pop records. They're still made in that way of using keyboards and a drum machine, but so was pretty much everyone else in pop music at that point. The guitar had become a bit of a thing you have in a cupboard because it looks nice. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting that out. Do you know what I mean? It was a bit like that, you know. Yeah. And so
I always, that stuff always sounds really sequenced and accomplished. And then and when you get like you get into the 90s and everyone had Atari STs, I suppose, and we're trying to do like Cubase and stuff.
Yeah.
There'd always be glitches on the fourth bar when it comes back to the first. It'd be like slightly late. And
interesting.
And almost imperceptibly late, but it used to really.
The timing of it, isn't
and
it?
And I was always going, how the fuck does Stock Aitken and Waterman do it?
Yeah. Well, they had a Lin 9000 and they never used anything else ever.
What's a Lin?
Lin 9000 was a Lin drum, but it was I think it was like second or third generation from the one that everyone covets so much, which is the sort of black and gold, brownie, purple, orangey one kind
so
of thing.
Is that a sequencer just for the drums, or is it for?
It was drums, but you also sequenced keyboard parts in it as well,
and it was quite would a big MIDI or like an early form.
Yeah, it would be MIDI. Yeah, and they only had. They probably only had like, I mean, they had anything they wanted, obviously, by the time they'd started making Dosh and everything. And they bought a Fairlight eventually.
Okay.
And they had a guy called Ian Kernow, who's genius of a guy. And he became their programmer. And it was a bit of a universe that opened when they did that, because Ian had sort of like, you know, toured with Talk and lots of other, a bit more kind of, you know, left field things as opposed to, but loved pop music and had a good sense of all of it. And so he'd be in there programming string parts and keyboard parts and all kinds of things that wouldn't necessarily be what I think anyway. Well, I'm saying that you'd have to ask Matt and Mike, Stock and Aitken. Mm. But I think for me, when they did the Never Gonna Give You Up record, because Ian had done all those strings and those brass things and everything, not taking anything away from Stock Aitken Waterman, there was something about that that was a little bit different to what perhaps they would have done.
Mm.
And I think that really,
what do you think the difference was? It made you,
well, I think, and I'm not even saying they didn't say to him, look, we're after like a Philadelphia string thing or something, I don't know what, you know, but I'm just saying it's just another musician. It's not the same two guys, because Pete Waterman, as much as he knows about music and was a driving force in it, is not like somebody who got in the room and got on the keys and started doing all of that, you know.
Do you feel like Pete Waterman has tarnished his legacy by doing all that TV stuff?
I don't know what his legacy is. I don't know what his legacy is, really. And I think it
well, I sometimes think about him, and I think like if he hadn't positioned himself as a judge, you know,
yes, I know
casting,
what you mean.
You know, deciding kind of votes on people's careers and
I know
dreams, even
if he'd just been like,
if he'd just been a guy that made all those, iconic,
maybe. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who suddenly have a different door open up. And don't necessarily think too much about it. And I think he quite likes, well, I'm saying that, I don't know about now,
being
but
I think he did
I think he did. And I think he liked being the mouthpiece of that organization and the whole thing, and like, and I think to his credit, without him being like that, I don't know where they would have got to, because the talent was there. But it's,
you
like,
know, maybe I'm kind of triggered by Pete Waterman, because there was a time when one of the contestants sang our hit, you know. And then he said stuff like, you really made that your own. That's the definitive version. It's a gimmicky song. And I was like, I've never heard anyone slag off a song that one of the contestants is singing. It's like, if you don't like the song, don't fucking ask me if you can use it on the TV program and then slag it off. And then I saw him backstage at the Irish ceremony. And I was wearing a jacket which had a lot of tassels on the back.
Right.
And it was all scaffolding because it was, you know, an awards ceremony. Right. None of it was real.
Right.
And I was standing there talking to the guy at Def Leppard and Kerry Katona. And then Pete Waterman comes along. I tried to blank him, but my tassels were stuck in the... scaffolding.
Oh,
and I was stuck there, like a, you know,
so
like
you couldn't turn away,
caught in a web.
Oh my god!
And I just had to be nice to him because that's what I do, you know.
Okay, that's what you do.
So yeah, but anyway, yeah. I suppose I just kind of wish sometimes that people who have made that kind of impact on, on an entire decade sound,
yeah,
would just not go on the telly,
yeah,
and say mean stuff about my song.
No, no. Well, listen, that, no. I think the thing is, when people are mean or say derogatory things and what have you, a lot of the time it's just their stick. It's just like, yeah, I can't just sit here and go, yeah, lovely. Do you know what I mean? Especially in that show, you know what I mean? Pop Idol, I think, is what you're referring to, isn't it?
But I wasn't a contestant.
No.
It was my song.
Come on, let's go and get him. I know where he lives.
Yeah, okay, you hold him back.
Yeah, no, listen, I mean, as much as I have a soft spot for Pete and for Matt and Mike, I haven't seen Matt for donkey's years, but I bumped into Mike a couple of times. I still have a feeling of, without them, I don't know whether I'd be sat here talking to you.
Right.
I don't know whether I would have done X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to defend them in the sense of that, or certainly Pete in terms of what he said about your tune and what have you. No, no,
honestly,
but I'm serious.
I think I only mentioned it because...
You're bitter.
I wanted, yeah, I am embittered and old. And I just wanted to... I think I just wanted to have said it so that it contextualizes any...
Got it.
You know, just to be in the name of open dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've got it. I've got it. No, listen, the thing is, he is... He's different. There's no doubt about it. And like I say, from the kind of A&R mouthpiece perspective, somebody had to be out there.
So what was his role in Stock Aitken and Waterman?
He'd very often he'd very often come up with the title and the idea of the song and say, look, this artist needs to be singing something like this. And he'd very often...
So it's like A&R almost.
Very much so. And he'd very often say, well, see this record... And he wouldn't be sat there telling you exactly why in terms of... I'm saying that. I'm about Matt and Mike, really.
Mm.
Or let's say Phil, one of the guys who mixed a lot of their stuff.
Mm.
He'd be saying, listen, the reason this works is this percussion.
Mm.
I'm not bothered about the whatever it was, the snare drum or the what. It's the top bit that's making it. That's the bit. Or even if he didn't know that or couldn't necessarily verbalise that, he'd be able to paint in colours or whatever and say, this is what I want it to be like. I want it to be like this. And someone would do a version of it and mix it in the building or what have you. And he'd go, no. And he'd bring the record down that he was referring, or maybe three records, and he'd go, that. And somebody who was musically, technically, whatever, would say, oh, he means this.
So that person would then say, oh, he's talking about this frequency range.
All of that. Yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
And it would be very often, I think, he just had an idea for something and he'd look at an artist who we're about to work with, or they'd just been given the gig of doing something with, or someone they found or whatever, and go, nope, we're not having any of that. It's got to be more this than that. Do you know what I mean? Or, you know. So it was very A&R what he did, I think. And Matt and Mike were the musicians. They were like seriously A&R, good musicians.
That's actually in the days when A&R meant something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I was going to ask you, When you started working as a T-boy, what was your ambition? I mean, presumably it wasn't to be an engineer.
I was signed as a singer.
Right.
I mean, he'd seen me in a band in a little town where I'm from up north on like a little show.
Which town is that, by the way?
It's called Newton Le Willows. Doesn't that sound
posh?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, it ain't. It's actually all right. If you drive
a working men's club in there?
Oh, there's a few, yeah. There were. They're probably gone now. But if you drive down the high street of Newton Le Willows, it's quite nice, actually. It is. It's like, oh, this is quite quaint, you know.
It's probably pedestrianised by now, though.
No, it's not. Not yet. Not yet.
Still a motorway.
But it's... When I was growing up there as a kid, it was quite a tough area because it's sort of dead centre in the middle from Liverpool to Manchester. Mm-hmm. It's Wigan, St Helens, Warrington. It's very, very working class and very, you know. But in lots of ways, it's not a bad place to be in a little band because pubs, I'm sure everywhere, by the way, did. But I'm saying in that era, you could get a gig in a pub as a 16-year-old. We weren't allowed to, but 16, 17-year-old, you know. Mm-hmm. So... And we built a little following there, and we this, that, and the other. We entered into a few Battle of the Bands. Mm-hmm. One, we completely, you know, got murdered, and it was a mess. But we learned from it, and then we won one. Yeah, because right. I was starting writing songs by then, so I thought, nope, we've got to have the catchiest song you can possibly... I don't care what the lyrics are. I don't care anything about it. We've got 3 minutes, or whatever it was, to get someone to go, what is that? Mm. So one of the songs was called Shake Your Ass, of course.
Brilliant.
And I had these massive
that would
big,
still be a hit.
So, of course it would. And I had these massive big yellow tom-toms that I used to beat, and Chris was on drums because we had a drummer by then. Second band this was. What am I on about? Why am I saying? Oh, Waterman. So Pete Waterman came to see that band in a showcase, and I actually seem to remember, I think he was at one of the Battle of the Bands trial things that we did or whatever. And he came to see us, and he kind of liked my voice but didn't want to work with the band. That wasn't what his thing. He wasn't interested really in musicians and all of that, you know.
He had enough of those.
Too noisy, you know. Mm. And I was a bit, I didn't know whether I wanted to do that, but I also thought, literally, and I've said this before, I literally thought, he has got a Jag and he's got red leather pants.
Oh.
So.
But what cut? Were they tight?
They weren't super tight, no.
So like a voluminous...
I'd never seen red leather pants.
Cut.
I'd seen them on... a generous cut.
A generous cut.
I'd seen them on TV. Hmm. I've never been near any.
Who would be... I mean, I suppose... Trying to think who would wear red leather pants in
Rod
the
Stewart.
Early... Rod Stewart, of course.
Or someone of that ilk. Or anybody
he
from the
have
Stones.
A generous cut, though. You'd be
oh, no,
there
wouldn't be nothing
vein.
Generous about that at all.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. No, yeah. But you know what I mean? It was like, okay... This is, you know, and he's got a studio in London with some other guys, and they want to do this, that, and the
was
other.
Was the upholstery of the Jag also leather, and did it squeak when he got in and out of the car?
It was leather. It had to be leather. I don't think they did a Jag that wasn't leather.
Unless great it was just red leather interior as well as
you disappear into it.
They're probably the Jag. The pants were probably made by Jag as well.
Of course,
you know, lovely XJS was it?
It was. It was an XJ6, I think is what it used to be called, which is the saloon.
Okay.
It's the gentleman's, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Did he drive it himself or was someone driving
it? Oh, no, he
it
drove it, yeah, okay. Yeah. So he actually picked me up in it to go down to London with
Were your parents concerned at any point that there was a man in red leather pants picking you up?
His girlfriend was in the car at the time.
That's cool, right.
And not that would have changed anything, but who knows? Oh, where are we going with this? Anyway, so we go down to London, and basically, I was signed to be a singer, and that was the deal. And they wanted to kind of develop their own artists, and I think the thing just took off for them, doing people's like the Dead or Alive thing, which was such a big record that it was massive,
huge.
And I think it was a turning point, definitely for them, but even possibly, dare I say, within British pop music at that moment of like, what is that? It's so kind of like, it just had this sound that people were going, and obviously, therefore, labels started going, we'd like one of those, please.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't have a Pete Burns, we don't have it, you know, but we want.
What a and voice
so,
he had.
Yeah, and so they just got inundated. And so myself and maybe one or two other people they had signed, I don't really know, I can't remember that actually, but we just got put on the back burner. But in a way, it was an apprenticeship. So I used to do my demos on an SSL desk, which they bought very soon after the massive Dead or Alive thing. I think they were trying to get one and got... Anyway, it doesn't matter, but they had one at one point. Mm-hmm. So at the weekends, I'd be doing demos using their keyboards.
On a fancy
and the one
SSL
Tokai Strat that they had, by the way. That was the only guitar they had in the building. It was a nice one, but it was the only guitar they had in the building. And using their sounds and everything. Wow. So all those sounds and all the things that was... Do you remember like a DX7 had a cartridge that you programmed sounds and all that and you could...
Let me show you a tattoo.
Oh.
Which arm is it on?
Sorry, Rick, this is... There's the big reveal.
Oh, my God, why? That's amazing. But let me ask you why.
Yeah, why not? That's the answer
okay,
to it.
Okay, why not?
I think because FM synthesis, it's particularly good at bass sounds and stuff with, yeah. with a lot of attack.
Yeah.
Chromatic percussion stuff. It's the way those algorithms work, the old-fashioned algorithms, not yeah. the ones they use on social media.
Sure.
I just think they're... It's unrivaled for a certain type of thing, and it's something that was very prevalent in.
But listen, and I don't even know how to say this exactly, but obviously you are known, and your band obviously, for being very rock and very guitar led and very real. And the DX7 synthesizer, as much as I love the history of it as well, and yeah. I've got a kind of a. You know, if I see one, I go a bit wobbly. Do you know what yeah. I mean? Because it was the coveted thing to have.
Yeah.
And it's all over my early, you know, those 80 records. But I'm looking at you going, and what I know of you and seen of you, I'm going, I don't equate that. I don't understand that.
Right.
If you had like a flaming Gibson there or something, which I'm sure you have somewhere, but you know what I mean? I
no,
can understand
actually,
that.
I haven't got any guitars tattooed on. Yet. I'm going into some tomorrow. So
there you go, then.
Maybe I'll address that.
But do you know what I mean? You know, yeah. If somebody would have said, name an instrument or the name of an instrument that Justin might have tattooed, that would come about. I'd be into the
I just love synthesizers.
Oh really? You do?
For what that does, there's nothing else like it. Yeah, FM synthesis is really interesting to me.
Why?
Because I'm a nerd, you know.
Okay, so well there you go then, you'll like this then, and you probably know all this shit anyway, but the Stock Aitken Waterman guys used to use a piano as well as the bass sound from it was the piano from it, but also the bass sounds.
Yeah.
And they had these cartridges that they programmed the sounds and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And those were more, what should I say? They were like protected than the keyboard. The keyboard was a bit like, well, anyone can get all of those.
All the patches are on the thing. Are they the hot swappable ones that you stick in the back? Yeah.
And like, because they knew they had like three or four rooms, I think. And so I think they just took the cartridge down or whatever it was called, you know, about that big, weren't
and then
they?
They probably put it in a safe.
Well, I'm not joking. I think somebody had all, and I think we were allowed to use all the sounds, I think.
Mm.
But like, if anyone was seen taking that out of the building, I'm not joking, they'd be dragged over hot coals. Yeah. It was a big deal, you know.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things they did, by the way. They put a piano underneath the bass sound as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how it was so percussive and so,
So it's, So
have you got a DX7?
I have, yeah.
Right, okay, amazing.
Yeah. More than one, actually.
Oh, my
Only
God.
Only one of them works, but yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. I would have never have... But there you go, you learn
something
about,
like, for an up-tempo number, like those bass sounds, they hit you more quickly than a traditional. I think bass frequencies travel a bit slower anyway.
Right.
So to have that sort of percussive end to it, you know, the envelope's just a bit more, I don't know, I just find it more satisfying somehow.
Yeah.
If you're trying to play a guitar along to it.
Right, interesting, yeah. Interesting.
Not, it doesn't ever make it onto a Darkness record, but then, you know, my musical existence is multifaceted. You know.
Well, it's also a bit of a weird one because it's so, you hear that thing, that keyboard, and you can't help but, I'm not saying if you're not interested in music or sounds of the, but anybody who's ever heard that thing, you can't unhear it. So if you hear it on a record, and it's sort of come back in vogue and fashion and everything in this last 10, 12, 15 years, whatever, where there's so many 80s keyboard sounds and stuff on things. But that one in particular, I think, there's certain sounds within it and things that it does that you just go, oop, and that's, you know.
If we had time to derobe, and if it wasn't so cold, I'd show you, I've got all the DX7 algorithms on my shot.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. This is interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. No, but can you understand where I'm coming from? That's the last thing I would have thought.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, man. That's really interesting.
So when you did the Glastonbury thing last year, do you know what I thought? I'm going to posit a theory as to why it was so successful.
Okay.
And tell me what you think. So I think the songs that you did...
Are you talking about the Smiths thing? Or are you
talking about the Blossom Smiths?
Okay,
Smiths thing. I reckon those are songs that everybody knows and loves.
Yeah.
But the person that sang them originally has become such a divisive figure that it's taken the enjoyment away from that material. And then when you come up there, you're not a divisive figure. You are a person that everyone was really happy to see on the stage, like brightened up the weekend, and then did all those brilliant songs.
Right.
It was a fucking amazing moment, and I think it's because it, I think that for a lot of people, that catalogue suddenly became accessible, and it was okay to like it again. What do you think of that theory?
It's difficult for me to even talk about it, partly because...
You were so drunk at the time.
I was so drunk at the time. No, I am quite sensitive to it in the sense that I was a massive. I still am, by the way. I say I was. I mean, when they were a band.
Yeah, in the moment, you were...
Yeah. My older brother, Mike, got me into the Smiths first. He bought first album, I think, and was playing it a lot at home. And it is a bit kind of like, it pricks your ears up straight away. And there's one or two songs that you instantly, you're in. And then there's other ones where you go, that's going to take me a minute to get my head around that. But I was kind of fascinated by them as well. And I kind of absolutely loved the fact they were from Manchester, which is where I went to buy jeans and T-shirts and records and just be in Manchester.
Cultural hub.
Because it was a proper city and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And so is Liverpool, by the way. But with my accent, I probably would have got beaten up in Liverpool back then. Not today, because the times have changed. But an accent was enough to get you in a fight, you know. So we didn't go to Liverpool. So when I met Blossoms... which was when the arena in Manchester reopened. They had a lineup, and Noel Gallagher was the headline. They had a lot of bands from the Manchester area come and play. I'm not from Manchester, but I snuck in. I was allowed to play. So we did our thing, and Cortina's played. Loads of really great bands played. So Noel was really lovely and very gracious, and he just kind of flung his door open and said, everyone in mind for a beer if you want to, you know, so come in my room. So we all did. So I was just chatting to these, you know, and I didn't really know Blossoms. I knew of them. I knew one or two tunes because they've had some big tunes, but I didn't know them, you know what I mean? And we're chatting. And then a week or so later, I did their podcast, funnily enough, and we just had a really good chat and a good everything. And we started talking about being a kid and bands and everything, and I mentioned the Smiths, and they were a bit taken aback by that, that I would like the Smiths even. And they are really big Smiths fans, which I find staggering because they weren't even alive.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying it still takes me back a little bit. So I think us doing it, we kind of, when I went up to their rehearsal place, because basically I said to them, look, I've always had this weird dream. Well, one day I'm just going to go and do a gig of Smith songs.
Wow.
I said, I've always wanted to do that, even though I've been in bands myself when I was a kid and and had my own career as a pop singer and all the rest of it.
But in your dream, was it Glastonbury?
No, it would have just been...
specifically
no,
a festival.
It would have been a little... just a venue. It doesn't really matter. A big pub will do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A venue. I just want to go and sing, because I have sung those songs throughout my life. I built a shed in lockdown. I quite like getting physical with things, right?
Yeah.
So, slate roof, by the way. You know what I mean?
Not to be sneezed at.
This is a proper shed.
Yeah, a real undertaking. Anyway,
and one of the things I did in lockdown was I went through artists' careers that I really like, and I'd go from song one right the way through. So I'd just have my headphones in and I'd be singing along in the back garden kind of thing. And I kind of just found myself going through the Smiths catalogue quite a bit. And I just love those songs. I love Morrissey's voice. I think he's quite underrated as a singer. People talk about his lyrics all the time, and rightfully so. And obviously the band as a thing, you know, as an entity or whatever. But he as a singer is pretty amazing, I think. And I love singing those tunes. So anyway, so I said this to the Blossoms guys, and a little while later, this, you know, they got back in touch and said, well, we've been thinking about it. We'll be the band. And I said to Tom, you know, lead singer, I said, well, do you want to sing something? He's like, No, we'll just be the band, you know.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
I'm like, okay, so we did a couple of gigs, one in Manchester, one in London, and it was just amazing. But when we did the first run, it wasn't even a rehearsal. It was like a jam just to see how, what, who, how could we, what have you. We all, I'm not saying we nearly burst into tears, but it was like, it was emotional. It was like, we, one of the songs we did was Please, 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 you know. And once you start that song, if you're a fan, it's very... filled with emotion, that I think. And so I don't know, so I find it a bit weird to even think about us doing it, even though we've done it. It's a bit like, what the
fuck? It's like you manifested that somehow. I mean, not well, at the risk of sounding like a intolerable hippie.
No, hey. Well, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, because you've dreamt it and then you made it happen.
Yeah.
In a really spectacular way.
Well, I've got to give credit to the guys, because they're not easy tunes at all.
Well, I wanted to ask you, actually, when when Blossoms and you did that, was that their slot, or was it something that you got booked because of the two shows you'd done in Manchester and London?
Yeah, we did the shows, Manchester and London, and there was a bit of chatter about it, and like, are they going to do that again? Was it just like a mad weekend? Yeah. Was it, you know? And I just want to just put this on cards on the table while we're at a card table, as it were. I was like, even if we never do this, if we just go in this room and do it, I'm all right with that. Just us getting together and playing those tunes and singing those amazing songs was kind of enough, really. And then it was just, I think the people who, you know, around them management wise and myself and everybody that, you know, we all, you know, just went, you should go and do it somewhere. So we did a venue in Manchester and one in London, and it was just amazing. The emotion of it and the feeling of it was incredible.
And we, I came, bet everybody in the room was screaming along.
Well, that's the other thing, and it goes back to what you asked me, and when you brought this up, is everyone in that room, word for word, knew it. Some people were 14. And then there's people a bit older than me, like in their 60s. And there was no difference when I looked in people's eyes of why they were singing those songs. I'm getting emotional about it now, actually. It's like... And on
I
the
thought
one,
it was beautiful. I said to you, when you walked in here, I said that you'd won the summer. I genuinely believe that.
Thank you. One of my favourite things that I covered last year, actually. Well, I think partly because it was so a bit odd to think that me, you know, that guy, is with those guys, and they're going to even do anything together.
So you are so detached from your career that you see that as odd.
Yeah, I do see it as odd, yeah.
And you know when you're talking about, let's circle back to Sinatra.
Yeah.
Is Morrissey one of the singers that you think has influenced you as a vocalist?
I definitely think he's influenced me in his... I'm going to try and come up with the right
word.
The way he
swings a bouquet.
Yeah, possibly. It's melodrama, is that the right way? He doesn't just sing the goddamn thing. It's almost like... I'm not saying he's acting.
But he's emoting, though, isn't he?
Yeah, and there's like a real persona on that stage. And to be fair, I mean, yeah, it's very difficult because of a lot of people aren't, as you said, they don't want to go and perhaps see him do that and all him at all because of things he said, and that, you know, I understand that, and I just separate the two things.
Yeah.
I just sort of say Picasso made some incredible art, but evidently wasn't the nicest human being in the world. I'm not equating that to Morrissey. That's a different kettle of fish. I think also, because to be honest, I do think it's not something anybody should be allowed to hide behind, but being really creative, being artistic, has usually got demons in it somewhere. And some way, that is also part of creating something so amazing, is because it's a
but
struggle.
You've never
to
said anything abhorrent.
Obnoxious and...
I mean, you probably have, but I mean, never, you know, as everybody probably has in jest, perhaps. But, you know, you haven't...
No, but I have got opinions on certain things, for sure. But I also don't think I would ever be somebody who people would go to for an opinion like that. I'm just going to take you back a little bit here.
Yeah,
right? Here we
please
go.
Do.
Here we go.
Let's rub the table as we do so.
Everybody.
So reassuring.
Not everybody. I say everybody. I don't mean everybody. There was a portion of people who absolutely hated Stock Aitken Waterman and anybody who came out of their building, including me. And so they might have listened to Never Gonna Give You Up, not realised you produced it, not the whatever, and gone, is that a good pop song? Yeah, it's all right, or whatever. But the moment it becomes, oh, well, it's Stock Aitken Waterman, he's a puppet, da-da-da, it's just all made in a sausage machine, and no, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't very nice. And every room I ever walked in, unless the other artists and people around the management and everybody were extremely pop, like a real TV pop thing I'd walk into, I'd kind of feel all right. But if I ever went where there was like musicians, I just think everyone in this room thinks I'm a twat.
Wow.
And wants to fucking punch me.
Wow.
Honest to God. And I think a lot of people...
I felt that in certain rooms, because I think for a different reason. I mean, most people thought that my band was not a serious thing. You know, thought it was a joke band.
Okay, I'm quite stunned to be hearing this. But
I mean, it's a lot of people dismissed us as a industry plant joke type band, you know.
Okay,
so I get what you're saying, but I mean, I it's really cool that you're kind of like willing to address that, really, because I mean, is that
but because it's painful to go through, if I'm honest, and also because I fall into some weird slots, I think, in the sense that as a kid I played drums in a band for a few years, I became a singer, I wrote songs. I just happened to meet Stock Aitken Waterman and went, what the hell's this? And they said, look kid, we write the songs, you just go and sit over there, right? And bizarrely, as it happened, I got four songs on that first album, and quite a few on the second,
self-written ones. Wow.
And that happened because, sorry, we're going everywhere, aren't we?
Yeah, it's good.
That happened because Pete Waterman wanted to sign me to like a proper label, a proper, you know. And cut a long story short, he chose RCA, went to see this guy called Peter Robinson, who's head of A&R. And Peter was almost on the verge of signing me anyway, I think. He was like, well, you know, yeah, okay. These Stock Aitken Waterman guys seem to know it. But he was kind of like, I'm going to have to hear him sing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So they hadn't recorded anything, really. We'd done a couple of little things, but nothing, you know. So Pete Waterman said to me, you know those little demos that you've got, which have done four-track demos at home at a friend's stepdad's studio, can you get the vocals off and come and sing to them? And I went, yeah. So I went back up north, stripped the vocals off, came back down, sang in the reception with a shitty mic somebody'd found in the building that wasn't for doing vocals, really, but whatever, you know. No reverb, through some bass cabinet 15-inch nonsense speaker, just in the reception. Sang these four songs, and Peter Robinson, who's the head of A&R at RCA, said, who wrote these songs? And like that, Waterman goes, oh, Rick did. He's a great songwriter as well.
Maybe.
So those four songs ended up on the record.
So
it might
good.
Not have been those four, actually, but I ended up with four songs on it.
Yeah.
And so all I'm trying to say is that...
Also,
I'm not,
it's worth mentioning, I think, that you sold, was it 40 million...
I think they make that up, to be honest.
No.
The first album I know for
These
a fact...
These are based on stats. Facts
okay,
and
okay.
stats.
I know the first album sold somewhere in the region of like 8 or 9 million copies. So having four songs on there was pretty amazing in terms
I
of
read,
my...
and I quote...
Oh, go on
if,
then.
If
yeah.
you will. Wait, I've made it up.
Go on.
No, wait.
I think what it is that it's,
it? I thought,
but it's the confusion of albums.
40 million
and,
albums.
I think it's the confusion of albums and singles as well.
Oh.
We sold a lot of singles back then. I mean, literally, I think I got a thing recently, and I can't remember how many millions it is, and I know that sounds a bit what have you, but it's a lot of
millions.
Yeah,
I know what you did as well. When they gave it to you, you said, put this with the others.
Yeah. Put that in the vault. No, it was really lovely, actually. We'd played at the Albert Hall, and which is an amazing godsend thing to do anyway.
Incredible experience.
And obviously, a lot of the label were there and everything. And I'm really good friends with some of the people there as well, and I've known them for a bit. And they weren't there in the first, because it's BMG, and they weren't there when I was signed to BMG, RCA, back then. But it's sort of become this interesting thing, because they still own the catalogue. So it makes sense for them to be helping me try and have records out today and kind of rejig that a bit and get it going again.
Yeah.
So we had this thing a year or so ago where, I can't remember what it is, but it's a lot of millions. that Never Gonna Give You Up has sold as actual singles.
They should just do a disc.
Just a lot.
Lot of millions. You deserve it.
Not in an Elton sort of lot of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But a lot of.
But yeah, you can specify that in the small print.
So, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say this, that I understand why people would think, well, he's just a twat. He doesn't know what, you know, whatever. And he's not a musician. He's not a this. He's not a that. I would totally understand that. And yet, if they would have looked at the album, they'd gone, oh, actually, he did write four of the songs. I didn't write any singles on the first album, to be fair.
Well,
I got a few
normal,
on the second. But, and they'd go, oh, and he played keyboards and guitar on it. Oh, okay. They'd still think I was a twat, but at least they'd have to say, yeah, well, he's sort of a bit of a musician then.
Yeah.
And I just sort of ignored it. I didn't ignore it. That's not fair.
It must have affected you.
It did. It did. Of course it did. And it made me just think, well, okay, well, I'm kind of tarred with that for the rest of my life then. Or well, I say the rest of my life. I was in my 20s. I was thinking for as long as this will possibly last. And that's what people
Did you have that thing where you wake up every morning and think, is it over now? And then you realise,
a few interactions
into the day, you realise that it's not over yet.
I think I had a few things where I realised it wasn't really, I didn't want to do it anymore, 100%. I just had enough of it, big time. One of the main things that became apparent was, I still don't like it now, I don't like flying. And I used to fly every other day kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I found myself taking trains in Europe and doing all sorts of things not to get on a plane.
Really?
And I've said this in an interview, there's no shame in it, there's no anything in it, it's just a thing. We were going to go to New York and I was going to be on a big TV show and sing the new song and all the rest of it. And we were on the way to the airport and I just turned to my manager and said, I can't go, I can't do this anymore. And we went home and he contacted the label and said, look, he's not in a great space, he doesn't want to do it anymore. And listen, I wasn't...
Do you think that's something that would, like, in this day and age, if like an artist at that level said something like that, do you think it would be something like one of those men's mental health crises type of things? Do you think that would be something that you'd bill it as now?
I think the thing is, I wasn't at the peak of my thing at all. I'd had like... an album that actually still did all right, you know, but compared to the others, didn't.
I always think about that. Like, our second album didn't do what the first one did.
Right.
But I'd give both of my testicles to have those sorts of numbers on an album today.
And that's the weird thing, isn't it? It's kind of like, it's just relative to something else. And like your thing as well, when your thing happened, it just went boom. And like, you couldn't, I don't think, unless you were under a rock or something, you knew who you guys were. And you knew those tunes. You just did. And if you've ever done that, everything else
Nothing else.
I've always said, first single, Downhill From Here. Because it literally was. It's the biggest song I've ever had. And I'll never get anywhere. Couldn't dream of getting close to it again. You know what I mean?
Well, what a wonderful position to be in to have that.
Oh, listen, I'm never so grateful.
How long did it take before you started to really appreciate how great it is to have had a song that's affected so many people?
I think what happened when I kind of had... It wasn't just a moment, but when I kind of packed it in, because I think the label were like, look, this isn't really going the way we want it to go either, and chances of having proper hits with him again, he's a pop singer, he's had his moment, so they were happy to let me go, I think. And so I just walked away and, you know, went off and all the rest of it, became a dad. Well, I already was a dad at that point, but... and it's only, I think, going through a few years of not doing any of that nonsense that you start to relate to what it was. If you're still doing it, I don't think you can be far enough away from it to know what it is and what it was and what the, you know.
So you needed some time away from it and a bit of perspective.
Definitely.
And,
100%.
Were you sad when you stopped?
No, I was relieved as
really?
Hell. Yeah.
Immediately?
Yeah.
And did you have like a shrine in one of your downstairs bathrooms with all of the many millions
in which house, darling? No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I just went with you on that. No, we're the only... The only disc we've ever had up in our house was, long story, name drop, ka-ching. I know Elton a little bit, and I'm also really, really good friends with Davey Johnston, who's been his guitar player forever, who's a beautiful, lovely man, by the way, amazing. I don't know if you've met him, but he's an incredible guy. And Davey would always say, hey, you know, we're recording in the townhouse or wherever we are, why don't you come say hi, you know, come and hang out a bit, which for me was a fucking big deal,
yeah,
right? Not just because it was Elton, but because it was Elton.
Yeah.
But also because this is a bunch of people who've been doing this quite a while at a level that's almost like they're like that. You open the book, and all right, there's Lennon and McCartney and there's the Stones, or whoever there is, right? Yeah. But he's in there, page one.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm going to go and hang out at the studio.
What's your favourite Elton album?
Oh my God. It's really weird. I went through Elton's catalogue when I did this thing in What's It. I still really love, I've got to be honest, I like Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah.
And when I went to the, a couple
of
gigs.
Can I tell you the correct answer to that?
Oh, go on. What's the correct? Go on, go on.
Madman Across the Water.
Okay, I know it's a lot of people's favourites, yeah. Mm. I think it also depends, again, because he's been there forever. For people who are a bit younger than him, let's say, or a lot younger than him. I'm trying to be polite, but I don't know what the best way of saying that. Anyway, I'm younger than Elton.
Yeah.
I think what I'm trying to say is it's a bit like Beatles records, even though they were very condensed in the time they made them in.
But he was doing two a year, wasn't he?
He's doing some mad stuff. But I kind of think when you come across an artist, that record you come across, which is obviously not necessarily the first or second or even third sometimes with someone like him,
yeah,
it's like that's the one you go, oh, well, this is interesting. What's going on here? And therefore it's hard to...
So Yellow Brick Road, what's the best Beatles album?
Best Beatles album? I'm not going to say Sgt. Pepper's, even though as a young child it definitely was.
Yeah, that's the one that resonated with me as a young person.
Because I think a lot of it's quite, in a beautiful way, is... quite childlike in its melodic content here and there, and some of the noises in it, some of the sounds, and some of the sort of.
But
like,
if you reflect on their catalogue as an adult, what's your favourite?
I listened to Let It Be a lot recently because you know the anniversary thing and all the rest of it. It's definitely later Beatles, and I know we all kind of love later Beatles because they were just amazing and they just got super experimental and like, what are they doing? It was like, what the hell are they doing? You know. So I'd probably say that, I think. I'm a bit of a moron. I very often, I'm at home and I'm on Sonos and I just go, just play everything.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily go back Revolver. Actually. And I go, is it or is it not? I can't remember. I'm not that bothered what
so
it's
you'll
on.
So you go for all of the songs?
In a way. I do. There are certain albums that I listen to and I'll go, as an album, that's incredible. I did it with a band called Love and Money the other day. It's a long story. I was cleaning the car. There you go. Yes, I clean my own car. I don't really clean my own car. This was a
is
very
it a
special...
Jag with leather
no,
upholstery?
It's not. It's an old Mercedes, actually. But anyway, nice. It's a present from my wife from years ago. It's a long story. Mm. Anyway, the rain had got in, so I had to get a sponge. It doesn't matter. Let's get on with what we're doing here today. So anyway, we're just going through things, and I can't remember why, but my wife said something about, what was the name of that Scottish band that did it? And I said... Well, it's love and money, you know. They did an album. Jeff Porcaro played drums on it. So I'm all over that already, right? Mm-hmm. And it was produced by the guy who did Nightfly and worked with Donald Fagen a lot. Gary Katz, who I met later. It doesn't matter. Anyway, that record, Love and Money... And it's called Love and Money. And it's called Love and Money, the album. Some great guitar on there, by the way. Okay. Some beautiful playing of every kind.
That's a really good recommendation.
Honestly, it's just, it's of its time, but it's a beautiful record. And every now and again, I definitely do that. I definitely say, I just want to play that record from start to finish and just remember it and hear it and feel it again as I did. But when it comes to someone like a Bowie or something, there's a lot of his records that I couldn't tell you what songs were on what. I'd really struggle with it. But I still love them. And I just think because of the last 15, 20 years of the way I've been playing music and listening to it and streaming it, let's say,
yeah,
I've sort of got out of the habit of going...
So you don't know, go... For, yeah, so a long player doesn't mean the same things it used to.
I do like it, and we do have a record player at home, mm, and once you start doing that, you do get back into it because it just goes across the thing and plays it, you know what I mean? But I think, mm-hmm, I think partly what it is, like we're having a dinner at home, let's say, and I'm playing something, or a friend is, we did it with Roxy Music the other night, mm, and he's going, oh my God, listen to, because Avalon is one of my all-time favourite albums, mm-hmm, so I was playing something, I think I just started Avalon, I thought I'm going to have that on during dinner and just listen to it kind of thing, and then before we know what we're doing, we're listening to Roxy Music from 10 years before, mm-hmm, and a bit of this and a bit of that, and going, hang on a minute, Brian Ferry's solo albums, how many solo albums did you, do you know what I mean? And that's, yeah, what streaming does to me.
Yeah, right.
You jump around a lot.
You rabbit hole, don't you?
Yeah, and it is a bit tricky, but I do... It's tricky in the sense of is it doing an album justice? No, because you don't get to track 8 sometimes because it sparks a memory.
And also, there used to be an art in the way they were mastered as well.
Yeah,
like even in terms of the song spacings and the way the experience of listening to a long player.
Yeah, and didn't they put tracks either towards the center or to the end that were less bass heavy?
Yeah,
because
that's how we've always done it.
We'd cut. Is that you? Okay.
Yeah, like so in a rock album, like an Aerosmith record, usually. When there's a ballad, they stick that at the end of the side.
Right.
Because the needle's closer to the middle and it isn't going to
react
doesn't
have
the same
as much.
Way.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Which is mad to think about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really.
Because I always just thought it was just the experience. It was like really involved lovemaking and then a lovely cuddle at the end.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and I thought that was the idea.
Interesting. That's what
with Aerosmith, it probably was.
Yeah,
the,
well,
you know,
I'm sure it was, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what we're on about. We're no, not around, but it's good.
No, but
very
the thing
enjoyable.
Is, you're obviously really passionate about music. And I wondered if that was why your hiatus was abridged. What brought you back?
Well, I think in a nutshell, there's probably two things. I had a little studio built in Fulham. When I say little, it was a really nice little setup. I had a 2-inch machine and everything. It was just at the very end of like tape machines and all of
so
that.
So tell me what year that would have been.
That's a good point. It would have been about 93, I think.
Okay. Were you living around Parsons Green in the late 90s?
That's where the studio was, in Parsons Green, but I didn't live there.
Do you know what?
Go on.
You're the first famous person I saw in real life.
You're joking.
Outside of, you know, a performance.
Did you live in Parsons Green then?
No, I didn't, but I did my first publishing deal with Rondor Music.
Yeah,
that was
I know
on
Rondor.
Green.
Yeah, I know some of the guys who work there.
Right, so I went round the corner looking for something to eat or whatever.
And went in the little cafe. On the
you were just crossing the road.
Oh.
And I was like, fuck me, that's Rick Astley. And now here we are.
Here we are after all this time. Rondo, I remember it well. Mm. Used to know a guy called Russ there quite well, and we'd have coffees in a little coffee shop around the corner.
Okay, did you ever meet someone called David Owen?
Yeah, I think I did, yeah.
Yeah, he was my main guy. Yeah.
Mad. Yeah. I mean, there's loads of little studios down that little alleyway there.
Well, they had a good one in the basement
yes,
there.
Yes, I know, yeah, I've been in there, yeah. No, I had that studio for quite a while. And it became a bit of a hangout, the studio, with friends and stuff and everything. And just, you know, I'd lend it to friends as well and all the rest of it. Blah, blah, blah. But I kind of, I didn't know exactly why I was doing it. I just wanted, it was a bit like I had some money and I didn't want a Ferrari. And I thought, well, I'll buy a nice, get a new studio going, you know, and I did that. And I wanted to write for other people possibly and produce for other people. I could possibly do it now, I don't know, but I certainly didn't have the chops then. I was fumbling about really in the dark, but I still loved going there every day and just making music and have my drums set up, mic'd up all the time and awesome. Everything, which is a proper amazing thing to have.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. But I kind of, truth of it is, I used to get offers to go and do my old songs, go and do gigs and what have you, sometimes with other artists from my era, like a nostalgia sort of thing. And I always said, no thanks, appreciate it, but no thanks. Not in a sort of, oh dear, you know, nothing like that. Just kind of like, no, I don't think I can bring myself to go up there and do that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then we had this offer, come to Japan and sing your old tunes.
Oh my God, it's almost like the Spinal Tap narrative.
It is, it is, honest to God. And I'm not saying I had to learn them again because they're just in there, they're in my DNA now. But I did sort of have to go through the lyrics properly and go, what's track 4 on second album? What is that? So, and there were a couple of other artists on the bill, as we'll call it. And I went, I think even when I went to the rehearsals, because it was like a house band that was put together to do this thing, a certain promoter had done all that, of English guys who went over there and everything. And I went to rehearsal and thought, well, that was really good fun, actually, just being in a room with a load of musicians just banging those tunes out. That was actually quite good fun. But then there's not the, there's a, still a disconnect of actually doing it in front of anybody. So, but the main thing was our daughter was about 14. She really wanted to study art at that point, and she did. She got a master's in art now, years ago. And she loved the idea of anything from Japan, you know, anything about Japanese art and you know, the design and everything. And my wife, Lena, had never been to Japan at this point. And they literally just got me in the kitchen up against the cabinets, you know, sort of going. And so we went to Japan and I did three gigs. And literally the first one, I just said to the audience, I said, look, this is the biggest karaoke in Tokyo tonight. Let's get involved. And we did the gig. Brilliant. And I kind of loved it. But it wasn't like, this is the start of something, this is a what have you. I just thought, I really enjoyed that. And I think the fact I wasn't promoting a record, wasn't really doing interviews. I might have done one interview for it or a couple of, you know, but I wasn't on the treadmill. And it was like, well, we'll be going home soon. Oh, I just want to throw into this, because it is actually, to me, it's important. My wife has worked in movies a lot and produced movies and all of it. She got nominated with the director, obviously, for a short film. So we went to the frickin' Oscars. I went for 24 hours to LA because I was doing something. Went to the Oscars, went down the red carpet in a brand new tux and all the rest of it, in all of my wife's hand and all the rest of it. Our daughter went. They stayed for a day or two. I flew then to Japan, to Tokyo, I think, to go on stage for the first time. So that 48, 50, 60 hours.
What a weekend.
Was mental.
Wow.
Like as mad as it could be. And I think the whole thing led me to thinking, well, you could do a bit of this.
Yeah.
You could just get up and
do a bit of Oscars and Japan stuff.
Yeah, maybe not the Oscars thing. But that, in a way, what I'm trying to say is it almost like turned it so on its head, so mad. You know, we stayed up all night that night and we just went to, as you
it
do.
It must
you
have get, been really... Because after a hiatus, when you come back and you've had that sort of self-doubt and that period of time when you think everybody thinks you're a twat, that can only get compounded by not being exposed to your own audience.
Yeah.
And then to have the courage to go out there and do it and then just be rewarded by, presumably, unanimously enthusiastic response.
Yeah, it was very enthusiastic.
And that's
sure,
Moorish as well, isn't it?
Of course it is. And I think it... But also I think for me, it was the thing of like... I think I felt when I had my few years at it back in the end of the 80s and scraping into the 90s, I think I felt it's all or nothing. It's literally all or nothing. You can't say no to anything. Someone just sends you this promo schedule and you go...
That's the northern man's work ethic. You just say yes to everything.
Maybe, but I think it was a lot of people's, I don't know about you guys, but it was a lot of people's like, well, how do we say no to that Italian radio show that wants us to, it's what we're supposed to do, isn't it?
Well, that's so what nearly killed me. Just didn't say no to anything.
Yeah, well, I'll bet. But also because, again, when something explodes in the way that your thing did as well, literally the world's your lobster. And it's like, you're getting asked to do all kinds of shit. And it's like, what do you say no? And also, you haven't done it before. So you think, well, we're not doing that again. That was ridiculous.
Yeah.
If they want us to come and play, we'll do that. But if they just want to sit us on a rock on a beach talking about this, that, and the other and going, do you never feel like, what am I doing here? This is not who I am.
Actually, the time when I had that most acutely, we were on some sort of Japanese game show. I had no fucking idea what was happening.
Right, yeah.
Not just the language, but just like, I couldn't figure it out. And so like, there's just me sort of looking around going, why am I here? What is this?
Yeah.
What even is this? You know?
Yeah.
Well, and there's a few sort of surreal moments like that.
Yeah,
you know?
And I listen, believe me, that echoes really strongly with a few things I did where I'm kind of like, one in particular, because I love saying this or whatever, to go to do a TV show in Germany, right? And I'm in the middle of my thing, so I'm used to going doing TVs, and they're all a bit odd. But ours are a bit odd. We just know them. Yeah. Like Ant and Dec doing whatever.
Right. Okay,
it's
that's
like,
true.
What are they doing now? It's mad, you know. Yeah. But we know them, so it's fine and lovely and whatever, right? Yeah. But when you go to Germany or Japan or something, and you don't speak the language, and you don't really get it. Mm. So there was one show that had, I think, like a mouse, and he was in like this camera was above him, and whichever door he went out for his bit of cheese, that person won something. This is a massive Saturday night TV show, right? And I'm looking at this and I'm going, and then all of a sudden someone brings a camel on, right? A live camel, which if we think about Saturday night British TV, that could easily happen, someone bring a camel on. But when you're in Germany, it's like, what am I doing here? Mm. I've just sung a song and I'm going to sing the new single in a minute. Mm. What am I? Why am I doing this? I'm kind of looking at people. I'm not getting stroppy, but I'm like, are you sure we should be doing this? Is this the show we should be on, kind of thing? Yeah, yeah. I wasn't even being that stroppy, really. But and then they said, ladies and gentlemen, Rod Stewart. And Rod Stewart came on. And I went, that'll do for me. If Rod's here, then
yeah, that's it.
I'm
that's
here.
All you need. I'd have been okay with the camel so. At this point.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, listen, we better wrap it up. You've been absolutely okay. Brilliant.
Thank you. Listen, I've really enjoyed talking to you. Yeah. I'm still stunned about the DX7. Honestly, I can't wait to...
I'll show you my other tattoos in a minute.
But honestly, I can't wait to tell people that, because I know they're going to see it anyway, but I've got a certain keyboard nut friends who are literally just going to be able to... They're not going to be able to digest that. That's going to take a while.
That's good. Well, I'm glad I've managed to startle you in some way.
Indeed,
thank
my
you
love.
So
thank
much.
You. No,
absolutely
thank
awesome.
You for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Rick Astley.
Thank you.
That was fucking amazing.
Great.
Wow.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.